Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I will be talking to the author of Defenseless Under the Night, The Roosevelt Years and the Origins of Homeland Security. The book is published by Oxford University Press this year, and the author is Matthew Dalek. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you on, to have read the book, to read this book of political history. Before we get to it and its important subject matter, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I am an associate professor in the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and my training is as a historian. I went to Columbia for my PhD, and prior to this book, I also wrote a book called The Right Moment, which was about Ronald Reagan's first campaign in California in 1966 and about the shifting character of California politics amid the social upheavals in the mid-1960s.
Yeah, the book you've written now moves us back in time from there. And this is a period of time in American politics that has been well covered by historians. Now, why do you think this particular part of the story that you focus on has not yet been addressed? Why hasn't there been the attention paid to this dimension of the Roosevelt presidency that you bring to the subject matter?
It's a really interesting question, and it is partly why I think I wanted to write the book, which is that the story of Eleanor Roosevelt and Vera LaGuardia and their time at the Office of Civilian Defense is usually a pretty unhappy one. I mean, it's often described as a kind of interpersonal misadventure and a series of political failures. And, you know, both LaGuardia and Eleanor Roosevelt are depicted usually in the space of a few pages in a larger biography or another work that brings them in and focuses on them, but their time running civilian defense is restricted to a very short part of the story, and it's usually a pretty unhappy story. So I thought that the more research I did, I thought that there was a larger narrative and really a set of larger themes that both interested me but that I thought had not been taken seriously. Now, the other piece, too, I should mention is that, you know, civil defense typically is focused, you know, people have written a lot of books about civil defense in the Cold War. Usually the focus is on some of the more absurdist and cultural aspects of it. It's how unworkable it was, the kind of propagandistic elements to it. And then even in World War II, when people have written about it, like in Richard Lingerman's book about the home front, civil defense is seen as something of a national laughingstock. And so I wanted to treat it seriously. I wanted to focus on the different visions of liberalism between Eleanor Roosevelt and Vera LaGuardia, and I wanted to kind of give it a context and not describe simply a kind of wartime agency, but talk about these different visions for what the home front should, what democracy on the home front means in the middle of total war.
Now, you begin the book with the Orson Welles of War of the Worlds radio broadcast. I wonder if you'd refresh our memory just a little bit about what Welles did in this broadcast and how listeners reacted. The start of the book is so compelling in that way.
Yeah, thanks. This was based on the H.G. Wells novel, and Orson Welles adapted it basically for radio drama, and he broadcast it on Halloween Eve, just before Halloween, so late October 1938, around the time of the debacle at Munich. And he basically, without telling the audience, really recreated an episode in which aliens landed. There was a typical broadcast of a Ramon, a Raquel orchestra was playing music, and then it was interrupted by a news broadcaster on the radio. It had the feel of verisimilitude, so it felt, you know, like a voice of authority had broken in, and the voice of authority, this newscaster described basically aliens with heat rays who had landed in New Jersey, who were starting to kill U.S. soldiers who had gone to meet this, who were starting to destroy parts of the city in New York City. And so the lore about War of the Worlds, and this was reflected in the newspaper coverage in the days following, was that it sparked a mass panic. And subsequently, in recent years, some historians have found, and I think persuasively argued, that newspapers overhyped the reaction, that not nearly as many people actually panicked. But what I was really most interested in is in the debate among newspaper columnists, intellectuals, political leaders such as Eleanor Roosevelt, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, for example, about what did it mean that the American people panicked in response to a report, a radio report of an alien invasion? Why would people be so prone to panic? And it's that debate that I think I wanted to start the book with, and to kind of uncover this sense that it is possible that civilization, in a sense, could unravel, that people could go mad in the face of total war, and that the United States felt deeply vulnerable to the multitude of threats that that people were reading about and hearing about in Europe and Asia.
Now, as you've mentioned a couple of times, Eleanor Roosevelt is one of the primary characters of this book. And you talk about the sort of the change of beliefs that she had between the wars, her different views of war and peace, and the different ways in which she was approaching the use of military force. I wonder if you could just sort of connect those two time periods in Eleanor Roosevelt's view of the world for us. Where was she, and where did she get to by the time your book starts?
So, yes, she in World War One was the wife, obviously, of the assistant secretary of the Navy, and was in Washington, D.C., and was fulfilling some of the traditional roles of being the wife of the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, but she was also volunteering in a variety of capacities, including at a Red Cross canteen and working sometimes 12 or 14 hour days as part of the war effort. And she was actually she heard Woodrow Wilson address Congress in 1917, asking Congress for a declaration of war. So she had a kind of front row seat to the first World War, at least from the perspective of the United States. But, you know, like many progressives in the immediate post-war world, quickly became disillusioned. And following the currents of thought in the post-war aftermath, she became a progressive. You know, she believed that, and this is was driven home in a sense by, she toured some of the battlefields with Franklin Roosevelt after the war, toured some of the European battlefields, and she came away with really a deep felt sense of the horror of war and all the widows who had been created by this slaughter. And so she began to argue that war was pointless, and that you know, the only answer was peace, and it was peace at all costs. But I think, to her credit, she relinquished, beginning slowly in the mid to late 1930s, slowly around the time of the Spanish Civil War, she relinquished these long-held, deeply felt pacifist views, and became, as I argue, and this is sort of where I begin the book, one of the most one of the more hardline liberal anti-fascists, and she goes around the country actually and talks to a number of her allies who remain pacifists, and basically says, "You don't want to go to war, and I don't want to go to war, but war may come to us." And she starts to make the case for a military buildup, for military mobilization.
Now, Eleanor Roosevelt is not alone in this pursuit. New York Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia is also involved. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about LaGuardia, for those of those not like myself in New York who know LaGuardia well. But as important as that, how he viewed these threats to the homeland and how he viewed these differently than Roosevelt.
Yeah, so LaGuardia is also a fascinating character, and obviously there have been some very good biographies written of him. He was actually a combat pilot in World War I, and he flew combat planes in Italy for the United States while he was a congressman, a member of Congress. And he was awarded various medals. He was recognized as a hero. People called him the Flying Congressman. And so he had a very long-standing fascination with and passion for air power. He also, though, like Eleanor Roosevelt, became a pacifist after World War I and in the 1920s. But beginning in the early 1930s, he was one of the, as far as I can tell, one of the earlier New Dealers to see Hitler as a grave menace and to take Hitler quite seriously. And he actually started denouncing Hitler. He called him a lunatic, basically, in 19, I think as early as 1933. And then by the late 1930s, he was denouncing Hitler, excuse me, as street trash, and saw Hitler, I think, as a threat to democratic norms and institutions, which he had come to believe in, and he thought that Hitler, gradually he became to believe that Hitler posed a menace to New York City and to other metropolitan areas, and that air power could eventually, especially if, as the war began, especially if the Allied powers, France and England, were to fall, that New York City and other major cities would be in Hitler's sight. Now, the other his other vantage point on this was that he was also the head of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, so he headed an organization of mayors from really the largest cities in the country, and so he also became a spokesman for the mayors who felt that the Roosevelt administration was not paying sufficient attention to giving America's cities the military protections it needed in this new age of total war.
Now, in 1941, Pearl Harbor is attacked, which brings the country formally into the war. But prior to Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt had created the Office of Civilian Defense. What did FDR intend for this office to do? And in placing LaGuardia and Eleanor Roosevelt at its helm, to what extent did these two agree with his vision? Or where was the differences between what FDR intended and these two tried to implement the purpose of the office?
Yeah, it's a great question, and the question leads almost to a discussion of the creation of a wartime agency and all of the unintended consequences, unforeseen consequences that flow from that, and also a recognition that really a struggle over what was then called home defense, what it even meant, ensued once it was created. So Franklin Roosevelt established this office in May of 1941. He did so basically under pressure from a multitude of advisors. Some of them wanted this office to do morale on the home front, saw it as a kind of propaganda agency that could keep people's spirits high, inform them about the war effort. Part of it was this idea of social defense, which Eleanor Roosevelt had long championed, the idea that as the country was mobilizing militarily, it also had to mobilize socially and economically and help people left behind and really kind of help finish the New Deal revolution by making domestic life more socially just, more economically viable for Americans, and give people a greater stake in defending their democracy. At the same time, another plank of this office was another part of its mission was to, and this is sort of LaGuardia's primary view of it, was to provide hard hats, helmets to civilians, was to recruit air raid wardens to defend against air threats and auxiliary fire and police departments made up of potentially millions of volunteers. And so there was really a great struggle, and Franklin Roosevelt, I think, agreed to put all of these elements into the executive order establishing this agency. And in a sense, as was so often his practice, he then let his aides and his advisors kind of fight it out. And it led to a real struggle between LaGuardia and Eleanor Roosevelt and a number of others about the direction of this agency, about how volunteers should be mobilized and also to what end. And one of the things that I argue in the book ultimately is that LaGuardia developed really a vision for liberalism that primarily, at least in the role that he inhabited as director of this office, was primarily about militarizing the home front in times of threat. Whereas her vision, she was supportive of some of what LaGuardia was doing, but that she also felt that just as important was establishing a wartime New Deal, making democracy more worth defending and winning hearts and minds also around the globe, that democracy was the best form of government, which was a way to ward off fascism's ideological appeal as well. So it was that clash among these liberals that I was interested in, and it's sort of a clash of guns and butter, but also between security and liberty and civil liberties. Which, you know, continues, I argue, in some ways in the Cold War and even through our post 9/11 times.
And how did FDR respond to this, what became a growing conflict within the Office of Civilian Defense? What was his response? How did he mediate between these two powerful figures?
Well, look, just to step back, so Franklin Roosevelt had other irons in the fire, so to speak, while all this was playing out. And part of the time he didn't want to be bothered by what was happening. And so he let some of these debates fester among the First Lady, between the First Lady and the mayor of New York and others. But ultimately, you know, he established this agency in May of 1941, appointed LaGuardia director. Eleanor Roosevelt became assistant director a few months later in September. And by early December, so really on the eve of Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, was becoming impatient with LaGuardia and Eleanor Roosevelt jockeying for position. They were both pestering him with, you know, we need more of this and more of that, depending on what their interests were. And so I think he was beginning to look for – and also LaGuardia had really become a leading fearmonger. And part of what I think he wanted LaGuardia to do was to help him make the case that the country needed to militarize, needed to mobilize militarily. And LaGuardia did that, and in some respects did that incredibly effectively. But LaGuardia also became a lightning rod, and LaGuardia was doing things like telling priests and rabbis what to say in their sermons on Sunday during a day called Freedom Sunday, as designated by the administration to celebrate the country's freedoms. And so LaGuardia, as he was becoming somewhat unhinged and really spreading a message of fear, you know, telling people that that you know they had to be ready for air raids, they had to be ready for people dying in the streets, dropping like flies, that saboteurs were going to come in, that they would be swept up in what he called the sweeping conflagration of insanity, as he put in the L.A. Times. FDR, I think, was tiring on him and was also tiring on his wife in this role. And then Pearl Harbor happens. And within 2 months, for various reasons, their positions, LaGuardia's and Eleanor Roosevelt's positions in this Office of Civilian Defense, they just became untenable. And FDR pushed out first LaGuardia and essentially pushed him out in early 1941. And then about a month later, amid this national scandal, which we can talk about if you wish, pushed out his wife from this Office of Civilian Defense position.
Just briefly in conclusion, maybe you can just wrap us up by just talking a little bit about what you just alluded to. Tell us about that next phase.
So after Pearl Harbor, LaGuardia and Eleanor Roosevelt, within about 48 hours of Pearl Harbor, of the attacks, they're on a plane going to the West Coast. And they take this really amazing journey. They fly to Los Angeles. They part ways. LaGuardia goes north. Eleanor Roosevelt goes to San Diego, and then she heads north. And she, for example, visits a number of cities on the West Coast, which was seen in the days after Pearl Harbor as the country's most defenseless region. And there were reports they had that, for example, San Francisco was being bombed. Turned out not to be true, but these were taken very seriously. And LaGuardia, on his own accord, started doing things after Pearl Harbor, like telling, going on the radio and announcing all Japanese Americans had to stay in their homes until the government determined their status. He closed Japanese American restaurants and organizations. Was warning San Franciscans, for example, that they were going to be bombed because he had predicted Pearl Harbor. And so the kinds of things that he was saying, on his own accord, he had just was doing his own thing and not really coordinating with the administration. Not at that point was not being helpful to the focus that F. Franklin Roosevelt wanted, which was also on the offensive military operations and getting the Army, Navy ready for combat. He pushed out Fiorella LaGuardia, and then Eleanor Roosevelt in early February of 1942, so within 2 months of Pearl Harbor, it was reported in the media and then Congress that she had hired one of her friends, a fan dancer, a semi-nude dancer named Mayris Cheney, paying her an exorbitant sum, hired her at the Office of Civilian Defense, so government salary, to teach dancing to children as a way of raising their morale in case the bomb should fall in the country. And this became the first a major political scandal after Pearl Harbor. And it was the story was everywhere. She became the biggest lightning rod, and this was just a political firestorm that FDR didn't need. It allowed the conservative critics to say that, as a way of attacking Roosevelt's New Deal, that Eleanor Roosevelt was trying to do a backdoor New Deal. And so Franklin Roosevelt pushed her out within 2 weeks of the scandal breaking. And James Landis comes in and takes over. But that was the end of their a formal involvement, Eleanor's and Fiorella's formal involvement in this Office of Civilian Defense.
Yeah, again, the book is Defenseless Under the Night, The Roosevelt Years and the Origins of Homeland Security. Again, the author who you've been hearing from is Matthew Dalek. The publisher is Oxford University Press. Matt, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Heath. I really appreciate it.